Welcome to part two of our conversation with Chelsea Gill about downloads from the other side. How did your gift work in tandem for you with your criminal justice career? Can you tell any stories about that and how it was used, how you used it yourself personally as you went down that road and went into the world of being a detective? And how also did your coworkers view it or did you open up about those abilities as well to them?
So as I was going through high school, obviously I knew I had the gift. I was trying to figure out, do I want to go into social services for children, you know, in homes, mm-hmm. or do I want to do the police? I said, you know what, I'm going to study criminology and criminal justice because you can do multiple things, psychology, sociology,
sure.
criminal law. And I said, you know what, I'm going to head in this direction and see where it takes me. So I invested into a private school that I knew that they had local law enforcement workers as the college professors. So I didn't have somebody that studied, you know, psychology, teaching psychology. I have a person that is a detective that has a master in psychology teaching the psychology class. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to know the nitty gritty of law enforcement. So throughout my college years, I switched from one college to another, and I listened within to take certain classes each semester because you have a choice after you get your prereqs in, mm-hmm. that I knew I was going to change. I was going to alter my ending. And I'm like, well, what? Like, I knew I was going to alter it, but I didn't know where. So I was like, I want to become a cop.
Sure.
Like, that's what I want to do. Studying that, I didn't want to become a cop. I wanted to be a detective,
mm-hmm.
but you can't do that without being in patrol.
Sure.
So I graduated with my master in criminal justice with a minor in psychology, and I actually didn't use that degree in the sense of working in the field. I picked that degree and worked for the fraud department of a very big bank,
mm-hmm.
and I was a fraud investigator. But as a psychic, I still to this day consult for the local agencies here for missing people cases and cold case files. So I used the degree, but it's all volunteer work on that aspect, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So I never went into I never finished to become a cop. I have the degree to do so,
mm-hmm.
but I said I'm only able to help one person if I'm in a cop car, where if I open up my corporation and I'm consulting on cold case and missing people files for local agencies, and then I have my patients and my clients, that's what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And at the age of 22, I opened up my corporation in New York State. And I'm still helping on cold case and missing people files, but it's all pro bono.
Sure.
I don't get paid, which is fine because
yeah.
I want to help family.
When you were working with the fraud detection and trying to find that, how was it almost, I'm going to make it, an analogy that we'll understand from our generations is, was it like putting a cheat code into the game in terms of,
right.
of like, oh, I can tell you right now when I have this list of things I'm supposed to investigate, which ones are legitimately going to turn up fraud and which ones are just going to be shitty accounting. did you already know, like, going in, this one is legitimately fraud and this person just doesn't know how to use QuickBooks?
I love it. So what I always did was, because we had a team, that I would look at it going, what is the worst? I know which ones are the worst, even without looking. For example, if we have a credit card fraud and it was only for $50,
mm-hmm.
that's very mild, but I knew that person was on a rampage.
Sure.
So I would assign my top lead investigator to say, listen, I need you to go here and do this and this. And then the little ones, like, the little ones, typically the $50 ones, you can definitely tell, like, no, that person just needed extra Christmas gifts this year.
Yeah.
You know, but like I then would assign, but I knew good, bad, and ugly and which way to approach and which one came first. I'll be honest, it was overwhelming because of how many people do fraud. So then I'm feeling all the energies of these people plus their families that they stole from.
Mm-hmm.
To figure out, we need to get it done now because credit card or your FICO scores on the line because mm-hmm. someone just racked up your credit card, and it ain't yours, that I always knew good, bad, and ugly. It was very overwhelming, though. It didn't feel like I was normal in the job. I always said I just wanted to be that fraud investigator leader that just did fraud investigating. But instead, of, I talked to dead people and listened and then did fraud investigating.
How did that affect you emotionally, being surrounded in a career that, you know, when you're looking for essentially people doing nefarious acts, you're which in turn is obviously, you know, negative. And that's what your job is. You're tasked to find people who are trying to get away with things, trying to defraud the system, trying to defraud others. Just that world, and then having to interact with the actions which they undertook, and then maybe sometimes, you know, with the individuals themselves or people associated with them. How did that weigh on you, you know, emotionally, just having to be surrounded by such minds, by such, you know, individuals and attitudes and negativity, as a person, as how you perceive things, being as sensitive as you are?
It became overwhelming to the point of, I remember that I resigned within about 3.5 years of that job title, because you would, me as being, I always say, like, I'm different if we're going to look at it that way, because I see things that you may not, or I hear things that you may not, but that doesn't make us any different. But the best way to explain is, I wasn't normal, because I would know the person that stole that credit card was a sociopath, and they're going to be doing something they shouldn't be doing.
Sure.
And I remember at that point in time, I was trying to, I always say, cleanse your body and protect yourself. But when you're working that 7 days a week, most cases, because of the holiday season, I remember bringing it home that I was just exhausted, and my husband just kept looking at me like, is this what you want to do? We know you want to help people, but is this what you want to do?
Yeah.
And because it was, he was my boyfriend at the time, but I was 19 with that job. I was very grateful to start that job and at 22 leave after working in corporate America for all that time, that it started to weigh on me mentally, which caused medical problem mm-hmm. because I just didn't know how to release all the emotion that I was feeling.
Sure. How often do you believe, and this is, you know, an opinion and experience-based question, when we're talking about going off the topic of fraud investigation, but when we're talking about individuals who have issues mentally that they are suffering from, when we're talking about paranormal things, and we're talking about they're getting messages, they think they're talking to a deceased loved one, or maybe they actually are talking to a deceased loved one, but they've also been diagnosed with a mental illness of some sort. How often do you think the world of mental illness and being sensitive to the paranormal intersect, but oftentimes, just in society, it's all brushed into the bucket of mental illness, and the ability or the message that's coming through to them with intent from someone on the other side is just being dismissed?
I think that happens, I'm going to tell you, at least 8 out of 10 times. I personally see psychiatric patients. So I work hand in hand with local therapists with grief counseling, plus schizophrenia and mental disorders.
Mm-hmm.
That they send them to me because I can actually get into the head going, is this person real that they are talking to?
Mm-hmm.
Are they being affected by something that's in their house that they keep saying is that they're hearing and they're being scratched? Where the local, it's on that everyday-to-day life, the doctor is going to say, you know what, you're seeing people, hearing people, here's medication, and you're diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenic. Where I do believe the afterlife does communicate with us, but there's multiple dimensions of the afterlife. So we can have that person that's saying that they're hearing voices, and they swear to God their keys keep getting moved on them, and their father dies, think it's their father, but they end up, say, getting the bed starts shaking at night. They're waking up with scratches. They're having nightmares, and it's turning a little darker.
Mm-hmm.
Psychiatrist, a normal psychiatrist that I don't work with, would say, you know what? I think, you know, the split personality disorder is coming out of the schizophrenic. We're going to put you on some medication, where they actually might be dealing with something darker within their home that is affecting their mental state. And that's why I'm very thankful that people locally trust me mm-hmm. with their patients to observe that, and then I take care of it. As a reverend, I can go into the house, or if it's something I've had to do, suggest exorcism on a place and on a person. Because again, 8 out of 10, they have something paranormal happening. May not be good. And say the last 25 years they've been dealing with it. So yes, it did turn into a mental condition
sure.
that we can't reverse, but we can at least help so they don't feel like they're hearing all the voices still.
Mm-hmm.
So about 8 out of 10 times, I will say, yes, paranormal is affecting it.
Are you saying almost in some cases there, it starts out as some sort of paranormal intervention that torments the individual, but through the conditioning of those just repeated paranormal interactions, it ends up kind of enveloping itself into a mental condition or a mental illness once the what we would call paranormal or spiritual or spirit interaction ceases, because their brain has been so conditioned to look for this or think for this and or find this, even when it's gone, it's now developed into something else.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. And it's crazy to think, because a lot of people don't think in that intellectual side mm-hmm. of what really could be happening. But your placebo, your brain, is the most powerful organ in your body.
Mm-hmm.
What you tell it is what it's going to believe. So paranormal, we know in a negative standpoint, preys on those who are weak-minded, anxiety, mm-hmm. depression, those who already possibly have a mental illness and are not diagnosed yet, it's going to prey on that.
Mm-hmm.
And once they did its job, it's got the damage.
Yeah. It's like lighting a match. You throw the match in, you know, into the fire. The match was once there, but the match eventually burns and it's gone, but the fire is still going. And so it's almost like if the match was the initial, you know, spirit or whatever you would want to call it that was making the interaction, it does its thing. It's burned. It's going now. And then it still has to be either put out or you know, let it burn. What to you has been one of the most satisfying parts or cases, if you will, that you've worked on and helped with in terms of, as you mentioned earlier, helping with finding missing people or crime scenes and cases like that? Personally to you, when you look back on what you've done thus far in life, what has been one of the most satisfying things that you've done? And obviously you don't need to name names or anything like that to protect privacy,
yeah.
but just in general terms, what, you know, if you can give us kind of the bullet points of what you've walked away from going, this really, you know, this is why I went down this path and I'm happy I have this ability.
About 5 years ago, I worked on a case of a young boy that went missing, up in the mountains, about 7 hours from me. And all we knew, all that was given to me, was their first and last name, their age, and their last known whereabouts. So I worked along, I asked my guides and my angels and God to guide me, where did he start that day? Because even though he ended up on that route, how did he get there?
Mm-hmm.
What events led up to that? And we were able to find remains, embankments near water, that he fell off the cliff while walking. He was intoxicated. But he ended up on that road because he walked in on his best friend with his girlfriend. And he got into a heated argument because he was intoxicated. That best friend put him in the car, and because people can be people,
mm-hmm.
he got that guy out of the car, and that guy was intoxicated and walked too close to the cliff and fell. That after 3 years, we were able to find remains. We got called on the case, and within 6 weeks, we found his remains to at least bring closure. Because at that point, we know it's a search and recovery. That we were able to bring closure to his parents, to know that it was not homicide, murder, anything like that. It wasn't suicide. It was an unfortunate accident.
Yeah.
But we were able to bring him home. And that was the most satisfying, knowing that I was given the gift to help people hear, but listen to the, from the other side to guide. So that was the most satisfying.
When you were on that, that case and you were trying to figure this out and find something, not knowing what exactly you would find, you said you were asking God, you were asking your guides. Were you also asking the individual who had passed away, is that something where they're able to in sometimes come back and tell you, I'm over here or my remains are over here?
Yes. So what you can do is called remote viewing. So I asked the young boy to, in my third eye, which is right between your eyebrows, if you were to stand up, what's around you? And I'm able to see. I always call it, it's like a peripheral vision. Mm-hmm. That I was able to see certain trees. But again, trees are trees. I don't know the difference between one tree or another.
Sure.
So it's like, okay, I'm seeing this type of tree. I'm seeing this type of rock nearby. And I'm able to touch. So I'm able to feel what type of grass. Am I in mud? Am I, sounds bad, was I buried? That I was able to feel around me. And that was used in the sense of if we were to see a bridge and we look down and we see, well, those are the big pebbles that Chelsea saw. Let's go down there. That it led to the area. But by the time I did the remote viewing and 6 weeks later, we went from summer to fall. So the grass changed. So at that point, things were overgrown.
Mm-hmm.
That we had to go off of certain smells. And we all know certain flowers have a smell. I kept smelling lilacs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I smell flowers, a lilac. And thank God, goodness, they were somewhat still blooming. But that was the key component to finding the body, from what I can see, hear, feel, smell, and touch from the deceased.
That wraps up our conversation with Chelsea Gill about downloads from the other side. A big thank you to Herb for joining us on the conversation today here at The Grave Talks. For more on Chelsea's work, visit ChelseaGillBuffalo.com. Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.